I will tell you this, that the Egyptians found emojis to be very helpful.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So today we're speaking with one of my favorite sources of all time, honestly, John Frankel. He's the founding partner of FF Venture Capital, a New York-based seed stage investment firm. You'll learn about how a VC has to work to become a better futurist on an ongoing basis, why an emoji is not a fad, but becoming the Foursquare mayor of your local sushi place is one, how much friction a consumer will accept with any new invention, why people are so scared of technology and AI in particular, and why it's not that easy to predict how things will look in a few years. So let's jump right in. I'm really excited about this. I wanted to ask you, even though I know the answer to this, since we often start with this, is what do you do on a day-to-day basis? How do you kind of describe yourself?
So I'm a technology investor. I'm a founding partner of FF Venture Capital, which is a seed stage firm based in New York. We've been around about 11 years. We have 73 active portfolio companies. Some of them are household names, a lot of them are not, because they're on the enterprise side. And we predominantly invest in US-based software companies. We have a few hardware, we have a few outside the US. And we're seed stage investors. So we invest when there's three or four people in the room, and we look to exit a number of years later when they're 100, 200, 300 people organization.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that it's interesting because I know I've spoken to you, you know, a few other times, you know, for some other stories that I've worked on. And I mean, I have this hypothesis, which is that, you know, venture capitalists, especially seed stage, they have to be good futurists in some ways. They have to be good predictors of what are the traits that are going to make a company successful, as well as an industry in a particular discipline a few years from now. And that's something that their investments don't pay off, and you don't hear about those people if they're not that successful at it. So the good ones, at the very least, have to be relatively good futurists. But I'm curious what you think about that.
I've spent too many years working in investing to not understand the notion of hubris. But the moment you think you understand something is the moment you probably understand it the least. And so my approach, and I think our firm's approach, is that we're students of the marketplace. That we don't think we're smarter than everyone else around. We just try to work hard to understand the landscape and what's going on. So the term futurist to me is at best aspirational, as opposed to descriptive, which is we try to think about where things are going. We've had some good hits in the past. We've had some, you know, good misses in the past. But we try to think about where the world will be in 3, 5, 7 years, the companies that come across our threshold that we look at, and we try to pick, you know, we look at 2,500 companies a year, we invest in a dozen or so. You know, we're looking to find those companies we think will have a secular wind to their back that are, to use the very famous Wayne Gretzky quote, going to where the puck is going to be, as opposed to trying to invest in something because it's the fad of the moment, capturing people's attention right now. In fact, that's often for us a negative signal.
That's also, I mean, it brings up the point about what is a fad and what isn't, because it's not, I mean, there are people who I think say emojis, let's just say, are, oh, that's a thing that's going to be around for 6 months, or something such as GIFs, right? Because Giphy is big right now.
Look, I will tell you this, that the Egyptians found emojis to be very helpful. hieroglyphics being hand-drawn emojis. But seriously, I have a view that everything is a fad. It has a beginning, a middle, and end. Telex was a fad.
Yeah.
All right. Telegraph. I remember going to weddings when I was a kid, and there would be a point in the wedding after ceremony and in the party where someone would say, "We have the telegrams from the people who couldn't be here." And they would read out the telegram. So, all right, people tend not to use telegrams anymore unless it's an app on their phone called Telegram.
That's true.
But so I think everything is a fad. The question is, how long is it going to be? Yeah, I remember a few years ago, Foursquare. Everybody was checking in. No one wants to do that anymore. No one wants to be the mayor of our office or the, you know, the sushi place downstairs anymore. But
which makes it easier to be the mayor, by right. the way. Yeah.
So if you start with the premise that every technology company is trying to change the behavior of people in a meaningful way, so change the behavior of millions of people, the question is that behavioral change something which is long-lasting? Permanence is too strong a term. Or is it something which they'll do for a while and it's kind of cool and then they'll get bored and stop doing it? So Foursquare became Threesquare, became Twosquare, you know, less so.
Well, it's kind of the thing that's interesting that I know you're joking in some ways about the Egyptians and the emoji, but it actually, to me, it touches upon an important thing, which is that you have to, for any technology or for any company, you have to think about what are normal, quote unquote, things for humans to be engaged in. What are things that add value, absolutely, that are additive? So
absolutely. A number of years ago, we invested in a company called YunaKey. And YunaKey is a smart key company. They power smart locks. So Kivo, which is the world's largest selling smart lock, Spectrum Brands, Kwikset branded product, you, rather than reaching into your pocket, pulling out a metal key, putting it into a metal lock and twisting, which is a behavior we've, you know, goes back 100 plus generations, that's how humans have behaved, is it better to replace that with a single touch on the lock or wave in front of a sensor to wake up the lock to then unlock the door based on the key sitting on your phone through Bluetooth low energy connection? And the interesting thing is that we think it is, and we think it will, once you go smart lock, you don't go back. The digital information layer is very powerful. Things you can do is send people keys electronically and the like. But when it first came out, it took about a second to unlock. Now, if you time the amount of time between you putting your hand in your pocket, you taking out the key, and you putting it in, that's more than a second.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like a worse experience initially.
Mm-hmm. You weren't doing anything.
Because you weren't doing anything.
Funny, yeah.
And it wasn't until they got it down to somewhere around about 300 to 400 milliseconds that it felt much better. And by the way, 100, 200 feels even better. Because it's all, you know, starts to feel almost instantaneous. But if you don't occupy people during that extra time you give them, it feels longer than. So these behavioral dynamics become very important when you think about it. But yes, we're looking about adopting behavior.
I think that in some ways that also touches, I feel like, the idea of, you know, all these new people coming into the workforce and or every... Like, the perfect examples, you take a YunaKey customer, take a 12-year-old, 13-year-old that uses something like that for the first time. They have not yet used a traditional key. So that feels like a more normal interaction because they weren't used to the
9-year-olds, 8-year-olds. So the kids' toys have keys on them. They understand that concept. The question is what's natural against it. There's, I'll give you an interesting sort of physical design concept around this. There's something called a Murphy door. Sorry, take that back. Not Murphy door. Norman door. And the Norman, the problem with a Norman door is a bad user experience. So you walk up to the door, and you don't actually know whether you should pull or push. And we all experience this, and sometimes multiple times a day. Doors are very badly designed. They're symmetrically designed on both sides, even though one side you're meant to pull and one you're meant to push.
Mm.
And it's amazing how such a simple concept of designing a door so that when you reach for the handle, it naturally does what you want it to do and works through. It's very difficult to actually do. And so, you know, this is something that you see in design everywhere. You come to something, it needs 5 clicks rather than 1. You know, or you go to Robinhood. Robinhood's trading app feels just natural, click, click, done. You go to that same You try to do the same function on a lot of existing broker-dealer websites, and oh my God, you've got to enter in 8 fields, you've got to click a box, an Arial box, and you've got to click something else, you've got to type something in over here. It's ridiculous how much user interaction is necessary to do something that can be done. Click, click, done.
And that's why, to me, it almost seems like, and I don't know if this is too much of an oversimplification, but in general, okay, consumers will be okay with 2 steps forward and 1 step back. And it, you know, maybe it's 3 steps and half a step back. But the point of it is that they'll be okay, most people, especially early adopters, with some degree of additional friction if it overall the experience is better. And if they feel that this is overall adding more as opposed to what they're losing, you know, because we're always losing something with technology. And then we introduce a new thing to help solve the thing that we just lost.
Sometimes the benefits are non-obvious. So coming back to a Norman door example, we were doing some construction. We wanted to put door handles on. And we looked around, and most door handles break into either a round knob or a sort of L-shaped bar handle that you twist. Those are 2 main ones. And they both have problems. The round one is difficult. As you get older, that action of putting your hand on and gripping it, it's really not an easy action. And the door handle ones, where you put your hand over a piece of L-shaped metal and turn it, those are pretty standard. But over time, the weight of that L actually weighs them down, so they cease to be horizontal. It weighs on the spring in the lock. So not many people think about this, thought about it, came across a door handle that SOS sells, S-O-S-S. They're known for hidden hinges. They sell these handles, and these handles are particularly used in nursing homes and the like.
Mm.
And they were designed to be incredibly low friction. And they were. They look weird, but they are so natural to use that it's such an uptake. It's such an improvement on the existing one, but they look different. And so they have a tiny percentage market share, and it is a massively better experience. And what happens with the handle is if you're going through, if it's a push, you push the handle.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a pull, you pull the handle. It looks the same, and you don't need that twist action, and so that's why a lot of it goes into nursing homes. But it's fascinating where someone actually sat down and said, let me take a problem that everybody has, they can't articulate it, and solve it. And they solved it in a way that's very difficult to communicate, which is why this is not on 90% of doors. And honestly, it should be. It's a much better solution to the problem. I think Apple's AirPods fit into a similar way, that if you use them, you go, oh my God, this is amazing.
Once they had it and they try it, then they get it and they don't feel like they're too ostentatious. It and they reduce friction in a lot of ways. And
yeah. Even more so, I think, with the AirPods, when you look at them, there are things you say, well, I don't really know, etc. There's a lot of doubt. But once you actually use it, you go, that's a great experience. And I think it is one of the highest rated products ever for customer satisfaction, way above the iPhone. I remember when the iPhone first came out, there was a lot of skepticism. And the iPad itself, when it first came out, a lot of skepticism. So I think sometimes good solutions to problems are non-obvious, and they do require a fair amount of convincing of people to adopt them. But once they adopt them, they're like scratching their heads like, what am I missing? So I think this human behavioral aspect and trying to understand how much is a sufficient change, but not too much, is important. Our investment in YunaKey was based on the belief that this was a change in behavior and was moving in the right direction. Once you go smart lock, you don't go back. But it wasn't too much of a change of behavior that people wouldn't adopt.
You talk about this, and I think this is a really important point. The idea of thinking about and being able to anticipate how you're going to feel. People can often imagine a certain aspect of here's what's going to be happening in the future, such as artificial intelligence and automation are cutting down on the jobs that we have access to. But they're not necessarily thinking about
And this is going to give us more time with our kids, or it's not thinking about, or there are going to be more value-added jobs in our society as opposed to purely automation jobs that people might not necessarily want if they had the option of moving up. So what do you what are people missing on average when they're just plain scared of AI and not looking at any benefits that might be coming up there?
So I call this the Luddite argument. And I call it, I think it's very attractive as an argument, which says the areas where we employ a lot of people in the economy are in jobs that automation can eliminate. Therefore, automation will eliminate them. Therefore, we will have unemployment. I mean, that's the Luddite argument. It didn't work during the Industrial Revolution. Now, there were a lot of jobs lost, but there were a lot of new jobs created. I think it was the mid to late 80s, there was a UK program, a bit like 60 Minutes over here, called Panorama. And they talked about the factories of the future in the year 2000, and how you would have three or four workers in the factory, and they'd spend most of their time in the gym. And every now and then, an alarm would go off, and they'd have to go and fix something, and then they'd go back and do it.
There's been data on this where it's like, even if you get something wrong, right, you predict it's going to happen in 18 years, and it does happen. It just takes 47 years, you know?
Well, there's an element of that, and I'm sure there are people still using AOL dial-up modems and, you know, telephone directories and stuff. But I get the long-tail argument, but this is a little different. There's the secondary and tertiary impacts that people don't understand. That the hundreds of billions of dollars that's been generated by the app economy didn't exist 10 years ago. There was no app store 10 years ago. All these influencers that are earning money, that job didn't exist all that time. I mean, there's so many jobs that didn't exist that can now exist. And fundamentally, when you apply technology to a problem, you generally take out the most labor-intensive and boring aspect of that job, and you allow people to do more interesting things. And maybe more interesting things is, you know, spending time watching Marvel movies and playing video games and being on Facebook. But generally, my sense is, you know, I work as many or more hours than I've ever worked in my life, and the people on our team also do.
Mm-hmm.
We have tools that enable us to do far more than we could do before, but that doesn't mean there's less people doing stuff. It means that more value is being created in the economy. And that value is a peculiar thing, but it is something that is being created.
Why do you think that there are so many people who don't notice or are... I think you're right. There are a lot of people who are maybe less educated or just don't spend as much time understanding the benefits of AI and almost getting to know it. And you're in a unique position in that you're invested and you work very heavily in this world. So of course you know it more, but why do you think people can't get better at predicting the positives? But we always, it just seems like generally in life, we're predicting the negatives and not necessarily, but here are all the positives that are going to come from something.
Well, a couple of reasons. Firstly, don't take anything I say for certitude. I said we're students of the market. A Luddite argument is very seductive. Being wrong in the past, it might be right at some point in the future. We don't know, but we're not seduced by the argument. We live in a peculiar world where different people believe contradictory things all the time, and where something can be stated and people interpret it all different ways. So I don't know why. I mean, I can't answer why people interpret something one way or another. I mean, you know, politics is very clear where we're getting contradictory interpretations of statements that are made on one side or the other that are read by people as completely different outcomes.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I think that there's another point, which is just naturally, if there's something that we fear, it's better to be err on the side of being a little bit conservative and worrying about that thing. And you might even argue that the fearful ones are the ones that, you know, procreated because they lived long enough to procreate. And maybe that's why some people posit that, and it's an interesting theory, which is just the people who are more cautious and worried about the future are the ones who are more likely to pass on their genes.
I mean, maybe. So I'm not sure there's going to be much Darwinistic genetic development of people prospectively because that's not how society works anymore.
Yeah.
But that's another issue. So coming back to your question, we try to look for trends we think are important. We like to invest with a secular wind to our back. And we think AI, which has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, as soon as something becomes mainstream in AI, it ceases to be AI.
And I know we talked a little bit about that before, just the idea that, frankly, from a valuation standpoint, people say, well, is there any AI, quote unquote, in our product? Well, let's throw that in as a marketing term, as opposed to, and the topic, and the concept gets watered down. But the reality is, yes, it's in some ways, so many products now that we don't really think of as AI, right? Yeah.
If you look at the AirPods, there's probably at least 5 different AI systems embedded within it that we don't even think about, aren't surfaced, aren't marketed about. It's just magic and it just works. But there's a lot of technology that would naturally be classed as AI embedded within it to make it just work.
Yeah. When you're thinking about AI and kind of like even moving past that also, what are some of the concepts and ideas that are most transformative to you at the moment and the most interesting? AI related or VR, AR, any of the initials, but really any area that you think might be, something of focus for you, but also something that the average CMO, chief digital officer, should be thinking about and isn't necessarily.
So I will tell you, the areas that intrigue us most are around applied AI. So the application of AI to create tools that didn't exist before that can be much more efficient at getting a given function done, or do a function you couldn't do before. And so within that, we're spending a lot of time in drones and robotics, so like across the field, and also in fintech. And we think fintech from a couple of perspectives, again, behavioral. We think, new consumers, less brand loyal than they used to be, that in a world of social media, brands count for a lot less than they used to, and they have to take sides, which is very uncomfortable. And if they do it successfully, they do well. And if they don't do it successfully, they don't. But we've seen, Nike and Starbucks both get political.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is an inherent aspect of the age we live in, that they feel the need to do that in order to manage and stimulate growth and carve out their market niche.
And I wanted to leave it there, just because John has so much to say, and there was really quite a lot of information in the second part of our conversation, so I really wanted to let it stand on its own. So look for that in the feed in the very near future. And thanks so much, John, for making the time to talk to us. Thanks to you guys, by the way. I know we say this a lot, but thanks so much for helping other people find out about this show. It's really meant a lot to us. This show was edited today by Jason Stack. And once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.